Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that follows the money behind our beautiful game. I'm Kevin Day, and with me, as ever, the reason we're here, football finance expert at Liverpool University, Kieran Maguire. Hello.
Hi, Kevin.
Did you enjoy your international break?
Oh, yes. Well, I saw the world.
Although we've firmly ascertained that if you were just listening to the podcast last week, that we are now 10 minutes later, but it's messing with my head in a kind of Doctor Who style fashion, to be perfectly honest. In this episode, finally, financial doping, which we mentioned way back in episode 3, I think, and I got sidetracked by a bright, shiny object outside and we didn't finish the conversation. It's how clubs inflate their income and push down their costs. And I'm promising you now, listeners, this bit contains my favourite Kieran story yet. And we've had some top Kieran stories, haven't we? Two of which, unfortunately, were in the pub afterwards, and we decided legally there was no way we could have them in. But seven have been brilliant that we've actually broadcast. This is easily the best of it. So we'll be asking why clubs do this financial doping and what are the consequences. Plus, why the Welsh Premier League champions are from England, and why Kieran cares so much, to be perfectly honest. And also, if that wasn't enough, Kieran gets, I'm going to say, slightly aroused by the financial figures for Norwich and Bristol City, the email chain we've had. I've never seen a man so excited in an email by talking about. If you thought he was excited by Juventus's accounts, my God. Anyway, and of course your questions. And once again, I do apologise in advance if we don't get to your question. It is because we have a lot of people listening to us, lovely people listening to us, and a lot of you have got questions. So we will try and get to them. If we don't, I do apologise, and hopefully we'll sort of answer it within the course of other things anyway. And join us again by popular demand, the star /victim of last week's show, football agent Jonathan Booker. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be here.
We've got fewer questions directly to you in this pod because you answered a lot of, very openly and honestly, you answered a lot of questions about an agent's role last week, and I thank you for it. If it wasn't for the fact it was 10 minutes ago, I would tell you that we had a lot of response, but in a week's time when it comes out and you won't be here, I'll email you to tell you we've had a lot of response.
Okay.
But you gave us a great deal of insight into the world of a football agent, and not all of it was what we wanted to hear, obviously, but we talked about various ways of being an agent, and you're obviously at the top end of being an agent, caring, kind. We've told you you're not getting paid for this, haven't we? This is the compliments, but this is the producer told me to just be really nice to you at the top of the second one, essentially. And you're buying the beers. Did we know yet? You're a football
agent. I'm definitely looking for the taxi now.
Yeah, so. Well, you're a football agent, so obviously you've got way more money than the rest of us put together.
Yeah, of course, everybody will tell
apart
you.
Apart from
that.
Kieran as the accountant. So, financial doping. This is something that you've talked about, Kieran, and it's something you'll be aware of, Jonathan. This is ways that club use to inflate their income, like stadium sales to the owners of the club. Now, I'm intrigued as to how they do it, but more importantly to why they do it, because as somebody who's freelance, your instinct is to try and keep your actual income down as much as possible with the aid of an accountant, so you don't pay as much tax. So it seems counterintuitive to sort of want to boost how much you're actually earning. Do you understand what I mean by that?
Absolutely, but given that this is all linked to financial fair play,
right,
and given that most clubs who are in a sticky wicket in terms of financial pay are losing money, if you're losing money, you're not paying any tax. So therefore, the tax issue doesn't become a problem.
Right, okay.
So there's...
Is there a way of applying that to me?
I'll speak to you afterwards.
Thank you. Mates rates.
So what is profit? Because the way that financial fair play works is there's two types of financial fair play. The first of which is you've got a limit on the amount of losses that you make. And the second type is a wage cap. So we take a look at those in turn. So the first one is you're allowed to lose in the championship. The championship is it's the car crash. It's the Keystone Cops of football.
You've always said, yeah.
And yeah, we'd said in one of the first episodes that between them, that the championship clubs had lost £570 million in a year. They have got to restrict those losses. So what's a profit or what's a loss? It's your money coming in, less your money going out. That's relatively simple. If you are losing more than you're allowed £39 million, or if you're close to that allowed £39 million, you've got a problem. So the way that the clubs are dealing with that is one of two ways. A, as you said at the start, they're going to inflate their income. So where do clubs get money from? Effectively, there's four sources. They sell tickets, they get money from the telly, they have commercial deals, and they sell players. Now, that's sort of the standard approach. So if we take a look at those in turn, ticket sales, they're actually quite difficult to manipulate because everybody knows what the prices are. The FA know what to expect. So it's difficult to manipulate or to be generous, shall we say, in terms of your money from that source. TV money, that's paid by the Premier League direct to the club, so you can't do anything with that. So we move to commercial deals. And commercial deal is somebody wants to sponsor me, somebody wants to advertise with me, and that's all fine. But we then start to look at the numbers behind them. And I think one of the first ones, which this is where this phrase financial doping came from, it was Arsene Wenger. He looked at Manchester City when they first signed the deal with Etihad Airways. £350 million for naming rights and some shirt sponsorship as well.
Mm.
And at the time, it blew everything out of the water. Why don't Manchester United have naming rights for Old Trafford? Because they think, actually, they can't get that much of a price for it. So they'd rather have the kudos of it. Hey, it's still known as Old Trafford. So people before had been saying, well, naming rights, it's spoken about, but it's not really worth a lot.
Can we do one of our customary diversions before I bring Jonathan in on this? Because the naming rights thing is interesting because it's noticeable that broadcasters now have started referring to the new Tottenham Stadium as White Hart Lane again because it is technically on White Hart Lane. So presumably they've got something in place, Tottenham, haven't they, for naming rights?
Well, they've discussions with it, but actually I don't think anybody's actually ever come forward with a big price.
And would that not have been part of the deal when they were building the stadium? Surely would. Is that not something you factor in, that we will get a percentage of this from, because it's in London, they're going to get a lot of money from somebody, aren't they, for naming that stadium, presumably?
Well, that's it. You don't get a lot of money.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a bit of a myth that, right, because if you take a look at some of the stadia, Scunthorpe of this season, they've named their stadium after a nightclub in Blackpool. Now, if I'm in, and Scunthorpe, I've been to Scunthorpe for an FA Cup defeat many, many years ago. Yeah, Bobby Zamora got sent off in the match. wasn't a good day out.
The only nightclub I'd ever known in Blackpool was the Pink Flamingo. They haven't named it the Pink Flamingo Stadium, have they?
I don't think so.
Okay.
And I used to run a nightclub in Blackpool as well.
What?
Oh, it's all coming out
every
now.
Every week I'm learning something new about you. What a life you've lived. You see my voice. The eyebrows went up. The voice went up an octave. You used to run a nightclub in Blackpool? You did?
I did, yeah.
What was it called? The Accountant's Rest?
It was called Frenchies.
Oh, was it? Oh, sounds wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I used to...
No, the rest of the pod's over. If you've sent a question in this week, you've had it. There's Frenchies in Blackpool. On the front, was it?
It was fairly close to the front, because I used to work for the administrators. And because I don't drink alcohol, I used to get all of the pubs and clubs in the northwest, because they send me out on a Friday and Saturday night to run them. So I've run places in Crewe and Liverpool and Blackpool and Wrexham. All the, high spots of... spots of the northwest.
I'm going to draw a veil over the night I spent in Wrexham after we won 1-0 there in 1980. Never mind, but Frenchies, I can. Anyway, I forget where we were. How much did you get for naming Frenchies?
Well, probably not much more than they.
I was killing time in Scunthorpe, Pink Flamingo. Yes, Scunthorpe named their stadium.
So, and you've got other stadiums, which Doncaster have just called theirs something new. The trouble is, everybody forgets them. Unless it's when the stadium was built. So you do have Arsenal with the Emirates. They do, because there wasn't an alternative name for it. Even if Spurs get a sponsor for the stadium, it's going to be called White Hart Lane by everybody.
Well, it comes back to, and we talked about it in the last pod 10 minutes ago, or last week, the Wham Stadium at Accrington, which I would love to think was named after the band, but it's named after, I think, a local cardboard box manufacturer.
That's right.
Which no one knows. So you kind of think you've kind of wasted your go naming the stadium, because even in Accrington, people are not aware that it's not named after the seminal 80s band. Before we talk about details of financial doping, I do want to bring Jonathan in here. In terms of a club's finances, and we know, well, I've learned from Kieran that sometimes a club's finances are built on sand, shall we say. Mm-hmm. So as a diligent agent, do you have an instinct about, if a club approaches you or a player, one of your players is approached by a club, do you research or do you have an instinct for whether that club's seemingly good financial situation is a genuine one, or do you think, right, okay, if they're willing to pay the money, the player will go there? Is that not a responsible attitude?
I think you always try and make the best judgment, as I touched on previously, with regards to the player and the longevity. Obviously, players are one of those parties covered by the financial protection given to football participants. But you don't want a situation where a player has his salary delayed for an extended period of time because the club is either in the process of a takeover or they've got financial trouble. And generally, some of the clubs will have, shall we say, a reputation in how solid they are financially at the moment, how financially solid they are going forward, how reputable they are with their payments. Do they delay, whether it be for the players or whether it be for the agents or whoever? And you generally get a feeling for it, and you speak to people, you speak to fellow agents, you might speak to other clubs.
Right, that was going to be my next question, because like, as a comedian, word soon gets round if you don't get paid on time. So agents would kind of warn each other, would they, about...
Yes.
They would?
Yes. In a past post with an organisation, there was discussions about whether you would have, shall we say, a list of those late payers, those ones who were quite awkward with payment, awkward with agents, so on and so forth. And that changes over time. So you've got those who are awkward deliberately, or those who are awkward because they haven't quite got the resources.
So awkward deliberately, in the way that some chairmen have been reputed to delay payments, yes, to local companies, for example, in the hope that they may go out of business and you don't have to pay them.
Yeah, because, as I said, the players are protected by the Football Creditors Rule, right, as are other clubs. Agents don't fall into that category, but you will get an idea if a club is going towards trouble.
Right.
And if you know a club is steering towards trouble, or they've got problems on the horizon, if they're massively overspent, like Kieran's touched on, you might well say to the player, well, this is one option, this is the club, but this club is far more solid and you're going to get treated the
right
way. But
there's nothing official, like in showbiz, for example, the stage will print, if a production company defaults payments 2 months running, the stage will print the names of companies that do that. And there's nothing official like that in football. It's all hearsay and your judgment.
No, it's judgment.
Okay. Well, back to the former owner of French's nightclub in Blackpool. You're never going to be allowed to forget that. You realise that. We're changing the name of this podcast. It's French's Price of Football from now on. Guy, our producer, who's very good at his job and sitting very close to me, between me and the door, basically. So until I'm out the door, he's very good at his job. There are a couple of specific things that Guy particularly wants to talk about. And then there's one story, you know, that I particularly want to talk about. But ways of doing this financial doping. So we've got unusual sponsors, multi-club ownership. The stadium sales to owners is something we have touched on, but not quite, so we know. So can you talk us sort of through these? I mean, presumably there are hundreds of ways that you can affect financial doping, if you want, but these are the ones that Guy particularly interested in.
Yeah, I think a lot of the ones are what we would refer to as related parties. So, right, for example, Sheffield Wednesday are sponsored to a certain extent by a taxi company, which doesn't appear to own any taxis, and a sports drink producer, which has only just started producing sports drinks, and yet they've been sponsoring for a while. So then you find, well, both of these companies happen to be controlled by the owner of the club. So,
right,
are the figures, you know, and there's no reason why they shouldn't be legitimate arm's length transactions at a fair price, but it certainly gives the critics, and clearly in a club in a city such as Sheffield, where you've got two clubs,
yes, the
Sheffield United fans are get very, very giddy about this. So that's one way. And then when we come to this issue of the club stadiums, this is something which has just arisen, because until 2016, and this is in the UEFA financial fair play rules, it says you can't sell a stadium to yourself, or if you do, the profits are ignored for financial fair play,
right, okay,
because it's not encouraging you to behave in a sustainable manner.
Yes.
And everybody says, nods along and says, yeah, that's fine. And the EFL used to have those rules. And then in 2016, the rules came out and you look through them and go, well, somebody's tip-ex that out. And nobody's ever given an explanation.
I'm going to pause here to mention to people under 35, you need to Google tip-ex. But it's worth it. For the love of God, don't sniff it. But do Google it. Again, that's revealing too much about my background as well. We've talked about French's nightclub in Blackpool, haven't we?
So, it's all out today. It's confession.
Whatever I reveal, you've aced me. Whatever, I could reveal anything about my background. I've been a stand-up comedian for 25 years. You've beaten me already with owning French's nightclub.
So in 2016, this rule just disappeared. Now, whether it was somebody just deleted it by accident or whatever the reason
that can't
was,
happen, Kieran, surely.
I think I'm being generous.
Okay, all right.
And then all of a sudden, Reading sold their stadium for £26 million. Villa sold theirs for 57. Sheffield Wednesday sold theirs for 60. And Derby sold theirs for 81.
I didn't know about the Villa one. The other three I was very aware of. The Villa one seemed to have gone under my radar. Was it big news at the time?
Well, I'd done the sums for Villa for last season, right, to whether or not they were going to comply with financial fair play.
Oh, and okay.
And a couple of other lads who sort of do something similar to me, we'd all looked and said, well, they're going to have to sell Jack Grealish, or they're going to have to go and sell James Chester, or one of their big players, because they the previous season, Villa, under the previous owner, Dr. Tony G, they'd spent a ridiculous amount of money. They hadn't gone up, and therefore they had to go and put the brakes on quickly. So Grealish would have to go, surely. And he didn't. And we're all looking around and saying, well, I don't know how they've managed to get away with this. And what had happened, new owners who'd come in, fantastic, they've saved the club. You know, Villa was on the brink of going out of business.
Was it really?
Oh, they were within an hour of liquidation. It was that close.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And you're probably tip-exing something at
the time. Yeah, possibly. Yeah, could have been during the tip-ex period. You're absolutely right, yeah.
And the owners, the first thing they did was effectively that they sold the ground to themselves or another company which they set up themselves for £57 million. And the profits on that will allow them to comply with financial fair play.
Can I just bring you in there, Jonathan? Is this a situation that is relatively common where you think this club's in trouble, I think they will be approaching me to sell their best asset? And does in a situation like that, if they were reduced to having to sell Grealish, does that make it harder for the agent because everybody knows that they need to offload and therefore they might have to settle for a fee 10, 20 million less than he's worth?
It comes back to, first of all, they probably wouldn't approach me because I do very limited representation of clubs in that situation.
Right, okay.
If it's my player and I represent a player that they're trying to move on, I will do my utmost to make sure the player's protected in that situation. Right. It really depends who they're representing. If they are representing the club to sell, we spoke previously about a transfer where there was a fixed commission for the agent and then there was an additional commission for the agent should he achieve a price above a certain amount. So both clubs who are in trouble and clubs who aren't in trouble but need to offset certain financial, they might look at surprisingly selling their best asset and they will go to the agents or intermediaries who they think are best positioned to do that.
Right.
They might not go to the actual agent who represents the player. They might go to somebody else.
Okay. Is that allowed?
Yes.
Oh.
Because that intermediary is representing the selling club in that situation.
Oh, I see. Yes, okay. But so what... has this happened to you? What then if you represent a very good player, the best player at that club, and the club says to you, I'm really sorry, but we need to move him on. What would you say if they said to you, look, we will take 20 million quid less than he's worth? What do you do in that situation?
In that situation, the first thing is to get that in writing. Because if you are encouraging a player to breach their current employment contract, it's like everything else. That is a breach of the regulations.
Oh, of course.
Despite what we might say, that certain people might go out there and promote the players before the end of their contract, so on and so forth.
I can hear many people at home saying, well, we all know contracts are not worth the paper, they're blah, blah, blah. But that's a question for another pod, to be honest, because we're already... So that's it. So you get it in writing.
You get it in writing. Me personally, I wouldn't represent the club in that situation unless they absolutely turned around and said, yes, do it. Because for me, if I'm representing the club in selling the player and getting the best price for the club, that automatically skews, no matter my best intentions, am I going to get the best for the player? Are they going to go to a secure club? Is it longevity? Is it the right thing for the player? Because that player's then got to move, possibly himself, his family, and all the things that come with that. So for me, you can't represent the club in that situation and get a fee there. Right. You've got to represent the best interests of the player. Once you've got their permission to promote that player to other clubs, they might well turn around and say, well, you can promote him to other clubs, but not these clubs.
Oh, really? Okay.
That sometimes happens.
Right. So clubs that are relegation rivals or promotion rivals or just clubs they don't like or trust?
Yes. Yes.
Really?
Yes.
There's an element of the playground in that, isn't there?
Yeah, very much so.
Wow.
As I said to you previously, common sense is severely lacking in certain situations. But other agents might well come to an agreement with the club to say, right, you want so much for this player, we can get that if we achieve that fixed fee. Right. But there are questions then about whether there is influence on third-party ownership in being employed by the selling club to get a certain price and getting a commission based on the transfer that you get. Okay. Really, it should be a fixed sum agreed prior.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. I appreciate that. Back to Kieran. Before we move on to other topics and readers, listeners' questions, why do I keep saying readers? Because it's Twitter, I don't know. Because I'm professional, but I like to give off the man of the people thing by getting things wrong occasionally. I lowered my voice to do that as well, because I'm professional. Kieran, there's one other thing. Even allowing for the Frenchies nightclub story, I think the story you're about to tell me in response to my question is going to top this, because one of the things that the guy on your... Transferring employment contracts is another financial doping way, and there's a particular player.
Yeah,
I'm taking my glasses off.
Another way of getting yourself around financial fair play is to reduce your costs.
Yeah.
Now, if you take a look at the small print for financial fair play, infrastructure costs, they're ignored. Academy costs, they're ignored.
So infrastructure costs,
building maintenance.
Stuff.
Yeah. So if you build, put in some new seats. That's great. Yeah. That's sustainable. So what they're saying is, let's encourage clubs to spend money on good things. Yeah. So women's football, academy football, infrastructure costs, community schemes. Yeah. Nobody can say, well, that's money being frittered away by clubs. Yeah, if you spend that money, that's not counted as far as financial fair play is concerned. And this allows clubs to therefore think, well, hold on, we can be a little bit cute with this. So there's a case which has been in print. So the producer's lawyers don't have to worry about this one.
Although the producer looks slightly worried. He looked up from his Sudoku just for a moment there. So,
and what happened was a club was trying to sign a player in the Championship, and as we know, the Championship it's where financial fair probably bears its teeth the greatest. The club didn't want to put all of the players' wages through because they were in danger of breaching financial fair play. So what they did was they got the player's mum on a contract as a youth team scout. And they paid her 700 grand a year.
Can we name the player?
Well, I don't think it's fair to name the player. All right, okay. And I don't think it's fair to name the player's mum either. But his dad's name's Paul Ince.
So here we have Mrs. Ince, who is now she's a youth development manager now, is she at Derby? What's her role?
Well, I mean that when this was under the old regime.
Yes.
So when Mel Morris came in, this was one of the things that he found. You know, and so that caused a bit of a ruck.
I have to say this in all honesty, I almost admire the chutzpah involved in something as blatant as that. In a way, I think as a Palace fan, if you'd go, I mean, even I, some of the things you learn about Simon Jordan, you go, oh, what a cock he is, but that's clever. Do you know what I mean? Every now and again, and that there is an element of that. You just think, well, it's wrong, but it's still making me grin. I'm afraid it's just ballsy, isn't it? Really,
it is. But it also shows just how weak the rules are.
But it worked as well, though. That's the other serious thing. There was nothing.
It appeared to work at the time because there's no evidence of the EFL or anybody having sanction against the club.
All right, let's move on. Let's calm you down a little bit before we get to Bristol City and Norwich's financial results, and then we have a listener's question. Hey, got it right. Which I want to get our guest involved in as well. Question two, the topic two. This is, and I've written this down. Why are the Welsh Premier League champions from England? ? And I've written here, more importantly, Kieran, why do you care so much about this? You've been trying to crowbar this story in since podcast one, and I've been valiantly trying to. But Cardiff can win the Premier League in England, so why does it bother you so much that an English club's winning the Welsh Premier League? Tell us the club about
The club is the New Saints, TNS.
Yeah, TNS, yeah.
And they are based in Oswestry in Shropshire.
Of course, yeah.
So this ultimately is a show about money, and therefore what's the driving force behind this? It's terrible. It should be a club from Bangor. It should be a club from Rhyl or whoever is going to be winning this for be the Pride of Wales.
But they've been in the Welsh League for some time, though, haven't they?
They've been in the Welsh League because they were, and they've won it 12 years out of the... Many occasions. The Welsh champions qualify for the first round of the Champions League.
Right.
And they get $800,000 for getting to the first round of the Champions League, which is more than any other club in the Welsh League earns. So therefore, they could have gone through the English pyramid system.
Right.
But, you know, realistically, what could they have achieved? You know, they could have got to the National League or National League North, and there's no money coming in that from sponsors and so on. If you know that if you just pay slightly more in wages than the rest of the clubs in the Welsh League, and you're pretty much guaranteed $800,000 a year.
So how are they financing this success then? Are they financing the success by the success they originally had?
That's right. It's circular.
Almost unbreakable then.
It's pretty tough, you know, and it's a real challenge for the other clubs in Wales. And if I was a Welsh football fan, you know, I'm a big fan of non-league football
and so on.
I just feel fairly cheesed off that this is, once again, just like we were saying, players are being treated as commodities. Why? Because of money. Here, we've got clubs making decisions. And why the Welsh FA has said, come and join us, is another matter.
So, well, they can't, once they join, it's very difficult for them to then kick them out. But so they're virtually guaranteed £800,000 a year, which then virtually guarantees them £800,000 a year, which means that the other clubs... So I almost owe you an apology because it is quite a serious matter. And I think what it proves as well, and joyful notice, is that we talk about the millions and billions involved in football all the time, quite casually. But of course, at that level, an amount of money that most football fans would ignore or laugh at means that much difference to the rest of the clubs in the Welsh League.
Yeah, it allows them to play players on a full-time basis, where the others are part-time.
And also that could guarantee, you know, just one other club winning that could guarantee their future for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
As a almost clever segue about guaranteeing future, your obsession with moving from the Championship to the Premier League and how that turns clubs into basket cases. Bristol City and Norwich, come on. Just tell us why you're so excited about Bristol City and Norwich's financial figures.
Well, it it's the basket case that we've got.
Right.
Bristol City, they were losing on a day-to-day basis. They lost 500 grand a week. And Bristol City, you think, well, they're a pretty solid club. How on earth are they losing that amount of money? And it's simply because if you want to compete in the top half of the Championship, if you want to have a chance of getting into the playoffs, then you've got to spend a hell of a lot of money. Now, to be fair to Bristol City, they also sold quite a few players last season and they covered their losses. Norwich, who again, you'd think, well, sensibly run club, shouldn't have any problems. They got promoted as champions of the Championship last season. Deservedly, they played some absolutely cracking football. They lost 40 million quid in doing so. And you think, that just seems a ridiculous amount of money. But what are the implications for when they come up to the Premier League? Well, who have Norwich signed over the summer? No one.
Mm.
So we've got this crazy situation that you spend an absolute fortune to get to the Premier League. And then unless you've got huge, you know, very wealthy owners, it actually leaves you with very little to spend once you do get there. And think about the three clubs who were relegated last season, Fulham, Cardiff and Huddersfield.
Yeah.
Fulham and Cardiff had come straight up from the Championship.
Yeah, yeah.
Huddersfield were in Division Two. Sorry, in their second year.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a concern that having worked so hard to get there, and people say, oh, you've got this £170 million, all this money is always coming to you. Actually, it can leave clubs knackered from the effort of getting to the top flight.
I mean, could you not argue that Norwich are being sensible and not spending money they haven't got? And if they go down, then they're in a better financial position than they were to come back up again? Or is that...
Yeah, I mean, in Burnley, Burnley went up a couple of times. They didn't spend money, and then I think it was the third time they went up. They by then had sort of built up a war chest. I'm a big admirer of Burnley.
Yeah, although obviously it's not what fans want to hear. They want to hear you're spending money to come back. And I presume, Jonathan, as well, when Norwich get promoted, and the other two teams get promoted, I presume every agent in Europe is pretty much knocking on their doors, sending them videos of players, aren't they? Is that
if they haven't already? They're coming to the closing weeks of the season, and the clubs around that top six, and definitely those top two. Yes, it is, and it's not always like there's the ludicrous nature with some agents that they think they can throw any player in there, and the clubs are dealing with an absolute plethora of information. They've also got their own scouting departments, analysis departments with their targets. But the number of agents who will throw CVs in front of a head of recruitment with no knowledge of the club, the structure, the mentality of the coaching staff, how they want to play, the age of the squad, and where that player fits in. So you're actually wasting your efforts. Like for me, it is look at a squad, build up, and you might well turn around to the club and say, well, what are you looking for? Well, until the end of the season actually comes about, very few clubs can say that. Because at the start of the season, the responsible clubs will look at, well, if we stay in this league, that's one set of recruitment policy. Mm. If we go up, that's another set of recruitment policy. And God forbid we get relegated, that's another set of recruitment policy. But some clubs don't even plan for the third option.
Really?
So they're not planning on, right, what do we do if we go, have we got to cut the wage bill? Because the money we get coming in has got to be lower.
Hence all the stories about clubs that are relegated with no relegation clause, so they're still paying Premiership
contracts. And that's where they then start to employ agents to move players on.
Okay. Apologies to our listeners. We've only got time for one question this week, partly because I want to ask Jonathan this final question. And it's partly Palace-based, because we've got the transfer window coming up shortly, the 1st of January. Palace are a club that always seem to do their transfer business in January around about a quarter to midnight on the last day of the transfer window. And sometimes that's worked, to be fair. Allardyce brought in four really good players at very short notice. But for most clubs, will the deals for the January transfer window already be done and dusted, and they're simply waiting and hoping that those players that are coming in don't get injured? Or are clubs looking to see who they can sell first before they bring somebody in? Or is it a mixture? Are there clubs that are always clubs? Like Man United, for example, always seem to get their transfer business done early in the summer, whereas Palace, for example, never seem to do that. So are there clubs who have policies on this thing, or is it just on a transfer by transfer basis?
I think from an agent's point of view, a lot of agents will now actually be thinking about the summer.
Oh, really? Okay,
if not January, that's gone and done.
Right.
So clubs will have their targets as well. So they will know what they're looking for. Now, that's to say, some clubs will have the same targets. It's natural. A good player will attract the same clubs. So they're not all going to get that. So the quicker they move, the better. Because then they're not looking at option two, option three. And for the responsible clubs, options four, five and six.
Sure.
And that's very much it. But I do believe there's a hell of a lot of brinksmanship goes on that is totally unnecessary. And whether it be club chairman, heads of recruitment, agents themselves, leaving it to the last, eking out maybe that bit more finance, that better deal, so on and so forth. But for me, and we've spoken about it previously, with players being seen as assets, that's somebody's livelihood.
Yes,
and that could be a 5-year employment contract that's going to affect that player for a long, long time. It could be a young player who may never make the grade. So that's the basis of them moving forward when, like so many young players, that the sport spits them out.
Yeah.
Or it could be a player at the end of his career where it's got to suit him and his family and his future going forward.
Well, also, I generally didn't realise this. Steve Parrish, and he did say it in public on 5-year plan, the Palace pod, he comes on once a year, which is very decent of him. And we do it at Steve Barrett's house, and he's a wine merchant. It's very decent of him. But Steve Parrott pointed out that quite often, in January especially, a club will have 4 or 5 irons in the player. So if Palace, for example, everyone's saying, why aren't you signing a right-back? And he will say, well, actually, we're in for 3 or 4. And if option one doesn't materialise, so quite often you end up with the fourth best option, or option one comes back in and all the other four, who you've been kind of spinning plates in the air, they're suddenly left without a club. So it does sometimes work. It's not always the agents involved. Sometimes it's the managers and the clubs that leave the agents in the lurch and the players, isn't it?
Yeah, and it is very much like they've got other options. And I've been in the situation, you're driving to a potential signing and you get a phone call and you're stopping that journey.
Wow, really?
The club's no longer interested in that player. So then you're thinking, where's option B?
Yeah, okay,
they're now interested. And clubs are much the same. Now, for me, I deliberately make the intent not to work on transfer deadline day.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes it's unavoidable, but I always believe you can get, if you've got the right relationships and people know where you stand, you should be able to get something done that suits all parties. Right. And it just amazes me that, you know, you get this attitude of people within clubs, agents, they wake up that morning, probably 4 or 5 o'clock, and they're thinking, right, what are we going to do today?
Really?
No plans for it.
Really?
Whatsoever. Whatever happens will happen, and so on and so forth.
Well, the annoying thing about that is that's what keeps Sky Sports going, isn't it, as well?
Yeah.
Where would we be without Harry Redknapp leaning out of the car window? We have only got time for one question this week, but it's a good one, and it involves you both, I think. It's from Jeremy Nash. He says, we often hear, especially at Premier League level, about, you know, a marquee signing coming into a club. Say, like when Palace bought Johan Cabaye, it's like out of the blue, where people say, well, it's all right because shirt sales will pay for it. Like, which is a thing fans still say as well. Great, the revenue. So, my first question to you, Kieran, is, and I can tell by the look on your face, really, it's not, the answer is no, the shirt sales won't. But it is, I mean, what's the economics of that? I mean, presume a club like Palace can only sell 25,000 shirts anyway at £30 a pop. And even if Cabaye's getting paid for the letters on the back of his shirt, you want to be Ruben Loftus-Cheek to get money out of that, basically, don't you? But so how does that work financially? I mean, is that a pinprick in terms of a financial deal?
It's an absolute myth. If you've got a player coming in on £100,000 a week and you've got 25,000 fans, it's simply not going to make any contribution.
Because they can only buy one shirt, can't they?
Exactly.
Yeah,
And the chances are, especially the player, to a large extent, is untried. A large proportion of blokes of a certain age don't have players' names on the back of them. So it's
they very amusingly have their own age on the back of them.
That's
Grandad,
that's right.
65. It's never not funny. We always, every time you see one, you have a new chuckle every time, don't you? Or when they even more amusingly, when an elderly chap's got 69 on the back of his shirt, you think, he's thought that through, hasn't he?
So unless you're a marquee player,
right?
Who where the club can sell those shirts around the rest of the world? Ronaldo, Neymar.
Right.
So if that player moves, then yes, I think the income generated from merchandise is of some significance. If it's a player moving from Club A to Club B, you'll get some eejit who wants to be the first fan in the stand. Like, oh look, I've got Johnny James's name on the back of my shirt, and you can end up looking really foolish because there was a Manchester City fan who had Ronaldo 7 on the back of his shirt because he'd heard a story and he wanted to be ahead of the game, and he looks an absolute pillock.
Well, at least he didn't get it tattooed, which is something. So Jonathan. Is that so? Take Neymar out, take Ronaldo out. Where on the list of priorities when you're moving a player to another club? Is that a conversation you even have about who has the rights to his? Is this all part of an image rights thing? Is it something that's so low on the financial priorities that you don't really care? Would you even get the club to tell you how many shirts have been sold?
Image rights is a thorn in the side for so many people.
And really?
It's so...
Clubs or players?
I think players, because they read and they hear about other players having that commercial element to their contract. Clubs, because they might see a taxation and an agent might see a taxation benefit and through management companies and so on and so forth. And I've heard some really strange stuff. But if you're the third choice keeper at a club that gets... I don't know, 10,000 through the gate in League One. Can you truly say, well, I've got an image and it's worth something? And no, you can't.
Right.
And I do know, and I'm very confident in this, I can't say it as a fact, but HMRC take a very dim view of image rights in player contracts, and they scrutinise them very, very heavily. And like Kieran rightly says, for me, image rights, you have to justify it, and you really have to be safe in that knowledge, what they're generating for the club. Commercial dealings, apart from that, there might be something in that, but that again is very, very few players, because a lot of the Spanish clubs, I think it's Real Madrid, they had a thing where that when they sign a player, they actually have something in their contracts where they own the image of the player to an extent. Hence, they can afford to pay that bit more. So they can exploit the image with sponsors and so on and so forth. And there's been, even that gets very complex when you get to the likes of Ronaldo, because somebody owns Ronaldo's image rights for one territory and the club own it for another owns it for another. And it gets very murky. But the majority of players for me who... would find it very difficult to argue they have image rights and justify that beyond their job as a player, in playing, in training, even down to the point where in their contracts they have the obligation to appear at community events, sponsors events, stuff like that. It's very difficult to argue you have an image.
Yeah. Jonathan, we will be talking about clubs and HMSRC in future pods because it's a question we've always been asked. I'm glad that you had the last word on this pod, though, Jonathan, because you've been a compelling and fascinating guest. And I really thank you for your honesty and insight. And I'm hoping it'll only take a couple of pints for you to start revealing stuff upstairs that you couldn't possibly reveal here. But you've been a really interesting guest. And I think you've gone a long way to countering some of the negative attitudes that fans have towards agents. So I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I'm sorry you had to hear the story about French's nightclub from Kieran. If you could refrain from tweeting that would be great. Kieran and I are going to have a word. Kieran, thank you as ever. The Price of Football is a Dap Dip podcast. We'd like to thank Soho Studios for hosting us for money. And we'll be back again soon. I would ask you to join us again, Jonathan, but it is literally 2 weeks' time this time. Last time I asked you to join us, you were kind enough to say, well, I've got half an hour, so I wouldn't like to ask you to stay here for another 2 weeks. But thank you for joining us. And I'd like to think, hopefully in future, when we have specific agent-related questions, we can get in touch.
Yep.
If you've got anything about the Welsh Premier League, that'd be lovely. Juventus's accounts, obviously. Thank you for listening. We're all upstairs to French's for a cocktail.